It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. We've got Om Malik, we've got Jill Duffy, we've got Harry McCracken. We're going to talk about the future of messaging, the future of social networks, why the big three German automakers bought HERE Maps, and a whole lot more. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 522, recorded Sunday, August 9th, 2015. The world's finest Panama hat. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Citrix GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from the convenience of your computer, smartphone, or tablet. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. For a 30-day free trial, visit GoToMeeting.com today. And by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one easy integration, you can offer your customer every way to pay, period. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/twit. And by Stamps.com. Start using your time more effectively with Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it right from your desk. For our special offer, go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter Twit. That's Stamps.com, offer code Twit. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting and invoicing solution designed to help small business owners save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/twit. It is time to talk the week's tech news. Time for Twit. And a good day, everybody. Leo Laporte here with Terry McCracken, the technologizer. Fast Company. Good to see you.
Great to be here.
Still with the iPad.
Still with my iPad and my Kensington keyboard. This is the one I've tried almost all of them, and this is the one I'm stuck with.
I'm just blown away that you, I mean, I thought like 2 years ago when you came here just with an iPad that, oh, this is just a little, you know, he's testing it out.
I think I'm heading into like my, I believe this fall, it will have been 3 years since I started using this as my primary device.
Nice. Wow. Also here, all the way from Chennai, a.k.a. Madras, Jill Duffy is joining us from PC Mag. She's contributing editor there. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
I apologize. It's 3:30 in the morning. I am so
Yeah, that's all right. I'm a morning person.
Did you stay up late or did you get up early?
I just woke up. Yeah.
Oh.
So I'll hang out with you. I might go for a walk while it's nice and cool as the sun comes up, and then I'll take a nap later.
How hot does it get there in the like the heat of the summer?
I guess I think this year it topped out around 110. There was a real bad heat wave here earlier.
I remember that. That was a big deal.
Yeah. It was a really big deal.
Yeah, I do remember that. Also here from San Francisco, and it's been so long since we've seen you. I'm so glad to welcome you back to our microphones, Om Malik.
Om, how are you doing, Leo?
I am great, Om, and I haven't seen you since the tragic fall of GigaOm. But you've recovered.
I have.
You feeling all right?
I
it must
am.
Have been a while of a little bit of mourning at some point for that.
I think six months is long enough.
Oh, jeez, yeah. But I can understand it. I mean,
we work in technology. Things happen. You move on.
Yeah. Your primary business now, and actually had been before GigaOm went away, was investing anyway, right?
I joined True Ventures full-time in first month of 2014. And I'm there as a general partner, you know, look at interesting technologies. And occasionally write on my personal blog, om.co. Hope to write more this after the summer is over. I've started writing for New Yorker and Bloomberg a little bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just, you know, occasional. I don't think I'm very good with deadlines.
Are you submitting little talk of the town pieces like, you know, you won't believe what happened in San Francisco the other night, that kind of stuff?
I wish I could. Nobody wants that. Maybe I'll write about that on my own own blog.
O'Malik, man about town. I like it. Yeah. GigaOM got purchased by a company called Knowingly.
I got no knowledge of that.
Yeah. Yeah, if I were you, I'd disavow it, all knowledge of it as well. It was so weird because I got in my feed, I got a new article. I got two new articles. I thought, what the heck?
Is it alive again?
Yeah. Two articles, if that makes it alive.
I haven't seen any of the new stuff yet.
Well, you know what? They're feature articles. They're not hard news articles, but they're interesting. You know, they're not very often. Actually, there's more now since I saw it. So they had an interview with Stephen Wolfram, and then they talked about the Reddit kerfuffle. It seems like there's only two people working there, but maybe more will come. Anyway, it's not even though it and this is the weird thing because it has your name on it.
It's a good lesson.
Yes,
you know, to start a company with your name.
Don't put your name on it.
I mean, next time around, I'm not going to do that.
Right? Don't put your name on it.
Yep.
Notice the name not on Twit. Nowhere does the name appear.
I thought, you know, that was an oversight by you in the early days.
Did you
now
really?
Yeah, I thought it was like, we should do a Leo Laporte show.
Yeah.
And like, well, in hindsight, that's actually better.
Unlike you, I'm an unassuming guy.
Yeah.
Om is probably the humblest man I know. In fact, he's a role model for everybody in the industry.
Totally.
Yeah. So great to have you back. It's good to see you. And I'm sure that you watch as things happen and wish that, gosh, I wish I had, I want to talk about that.
Okay.
Have you felt that way lately?
Things about
tech stories that you go, I would love to.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All the time.
I'd love to weigh in on this Reddit controversy, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you know. A lot. Like, you know, you can't change your stripes just because, you know, you're not in the game anymore.
I noticed when I was on vacation, I would do that. I would just stand in front of the mirror and talk for half an hour about something. It's really kind of embarrassing. Anything happened this week? I feel like, I don't know. Did anything go on this week? Any big stories in the news? I read a great story on Wired Magazine, actually kind of caught my interest about messaging. Actually, I thought this would be kind of a fun one to start with. It's author David Pierce says, can we just decide to have one messaging platform that we all use? I feel like the next big thing, there it is. Kill the ad. It says, screw texting. It's time to pick a universal messaging app. In the States, we use SMS, but there are a lot of apps vying for our attention. And when you hear that, Facebook paid $22 billion for WhatsApp, I think a lot of people in the U.S. were puzzled by that. Like, how could that be worth that much? But in fact, outside of the States, these apps are dominant. Pierce talks about WeChat.
WeChat is huge.
In China, 500,000 active users. And he points out it's more than just messaging. I mean, there are WeChat stars, just there is YouTube or Instagram stars or Vine stars, that people buy train tickets. They get their laundry done. They do everything. Live in WeChat, which I haven't had that experience.
Same thing in Japan with Line.
Line is amazing.
People live on Line, and it really is sort of an all-inclusive platform. You play games on it. You order pizza on it.
We are, meanwhile, in the States, kind of in a situation, I guess, kind of as instant messaging was in the early days, where there's people on ICQ, there's people on AIM, there's people on Microsoft Messenger. There's no unified platform. Is that do you think, and this is the question I'll pose you all, is that the next big thing? I mean, messaging?
Messaging is already here as the next big thing, and Facebook really wants to take Messenger and make it into something a lot more like WeChat or Line, you know. Last year, when Facebook told everybody that they were splitting off Messenger from Facebook and you'd have to download and use a different app, it ticked off a lot of people and people were puzzled. And it became clear eventually that the reason they did it was because they wanted to make Messenger into an all-encompassing platform, similar to the ones people use in other countries.
Yeah, it's obvious now. Although after all, Facebook buy WhatsApp?
They also bought WhatsApp, so they have two of them. And WhatsApp, I mean, the theory is, it won't be like that. WhatsApp is going to stick to its knitting and be focused on messaging. And it's never going to be inundated with ads because they won't do advertising.
What do you... Go ahead, Om.
the funny thing is that I read that article, and my first reaction was an old person reaction. Yeah, we need a unified messaging app. But in reality is today, the different demographics, different people, different geographic locations, people use applications differently. So that is why we have so many different applications. So, you know, Slack has a certain purpose in our life, just like SMS or iMessage has a certain purpose in WhatsApp, and so is Facebook Messenger. So I think to dream of a unified app is just kind of like a childish dream to have. I think there should be a little bit more interoperability between these various services. But I think it's more like, you know, think of messaging platforms as communication network. All social networks, if you look at the way they are essentially messaging or communication platform. Facebook, you know, people communicated through status and photos and updates, and then it became messages, and now there is they have a Facebook Messenger. So I think we have messaging and communications are core to social human behavior, and like every so often we reinvent it. I think if you remember Skype when they came out, since all the people were on Skype, Skype took off and all the other services didn't really take off, even though they were still there. Now you see the same thing with the current generation of messaging apps. They're taking off because, you know, we just like to communicate all the time. That's like a very fundamental human need. I think it's like something I've been writing about for almost 20 plus years, is that we always overlook that at the end of the day, what really makes the internet work is our ability to communicate and interact. The next generation of interaction is essentially WhatsApp and WeChat. So, and they will all remain this, you know, different from each other. I don't think that we need to have all of them in one package, like the way the Wired writer was trying to persuade us.
But if that's true, how do you account for the fact that WeChat is used by 500 million people, or that Line is used by is it the majority of Japanese users?
I mean, everybody has a Line ID.
Yeah.
It's even though it's a messaging app, it's more comparable to Facebook in terms of sort of its importance.
We've had unified apps before, like Trillion and Pigeon. And
those do.
It's never as satisfying, though, it seems to me, as using... No. If we were all using one app. Jill, what do you... Now, you're in an interesting position.
I use WhatsApp a lot. Yeah, I have a lot of international friends, and we use WhatsApp as a simple messenger that everybody signed up for early on. I think it was sort of similar to Skype in the early days. Everybody's got a Skype account. This is what we were going to use. And it was a simple enough tool that once we all had accounts, it was fine. I think when you look at something like the Chinese market, you know, you have to remember that it's its own market in a lot of ways. You have a lot of people in one country that has its own special technological challenges. So it makes sense that in the timeline of how China's technology has rolled out, that they came to have a different messaging platform among the majority of their people at a different time than other parts of the world. And I agree with what Om was saying too, that, you know, I don't want one messenger for all of my needs. So when I use business communication tools, right, I want to have something else that lets me more easily search my history, upload large files, mark up PDFs. And that's a different kind of service than maybe having very private, quick one-on-one communication with my friends, where my main concern there is, did they get my message? Did they read my message? Yeah. You know, that's all I want is that confirmation. So I think they're very, very different uses. And I think there should be a lot of room for lots of different messengers.
You don't want to use a messaging app that your parents use.
Oh, no, I certainly want my mom to be able to message me.
No, you want to use the same one as they use when you message them, but not the same one you use when you message your friends. Or is that
I don't know if I'd agree with that. I mean, the other one that I use is
My kids don't want to use the messenger app I use, that's for sure. What is the other one, SMS?
No, just iMessages through app.
So here's the issue.
Most of my U.S. friends have Apple products.
Because they all have iPhones.
Right, and Macs. Right?
I don't like being a green bubble on your phone.
Once Apple enabled everything to be synchronous, right? So that you could get messages and SMS on your Mac and on your iPad as well as your phone. That kind of helped that platform move along. So again, we don't have to rely on having a cellular network. We can use it over Wi-Fi. So for a lot of people, that works too.
It doesn't seem like the ideal situation. I reject your premise, Om, that I'm just an old man.
Have you looked in the mirror lately?
I feel like all of us would like one platform that just does it all. No?
I agree with Om that interoperability would be nice, but we've been waiting for it since the 1990s. At one point, when it was all about AIM versus ICQ versus MSN Messenger, the theory was they'd all talk to each other, and that went almost nowhere. Yeah. And I don't see any evidence today that any of the major platforms are serious about
there's
letting
no
you
incentive.
Talk to anybody else. Yeah, they want to keep you within their garden walls.
Facebook has added payments to Messenger. By the way, they've got to come up with a new name since they're all Messenger, right? This is very confusing. Well, maybe that's intentional. They want it to be the Messenger. They're, according to this article, rumored to be doing something called MoneyPenny, which would be a personal assistant messenger, like kind of an automated personal assistant. Those things exist already. And here's an interesting listing from Apple for an applications engineer for Android. And what's really interesting, of course, you figure, well, Apple Music needs an Android app, although if they're not well on their way to finishing that, then they're in trouble. The implication is it says exciting new mobile products to the Android platform besides the Music and Move apps. I find that intriguing. Maybe Apple wants to do a native Android iMessage. What do you think?
That would make you happy.
Well, it feels like they all would love to. Wouldn't you want to be the guy? Wouldn't you want to be WeChat in China or Line in Japan? Wouldn't you want to be that guy?
When FaceTime came out originally, they said they were going to open it up.
Yeah, never did.
And they still haven't. Although they never said they were going to write all the apps themselves. They said they would let other people write the apps.
Apple, and that's my complaint with, even though you can use iMessage with SMS, I'm always a blue green bubble in the message. And apparently, I didn't even know this, people discriminate against green bubbles.
Also, if you jump back and forth, it's a real headache.
I'm told, and there was, I'm told by my kids, oh yeah, when we're doing group messaging, you can't be part of group messaging because you're a green bubble. So we just leave you out. We don't include you.
Well, I think that's kind of a good point, too, is that social networks are social, right? And messaging, I would say, is a social network. The way that people behave online is similar to the way that we behave in life. And especially when you're younger, you don't want to be one of the large group, right? Like, you don't necessarily want to be included in the biggest thing. You want to have your own niche environment where people are like you, right? So it's that social behavior of wanting to be with your group. And I think that can certainly happen with messaging, right? Like, you want to be in the platform that is representative of you and your people. I would say what makes something like WeChat successful is that has that within it, right? Like, there are sort of subcultures within WeChat. So maybe that's part of the problem, is that the messaging platforms we have don't allow for that differentiation between people.
We have, I told my wife, can we just use Facebook Messenger? Because it's got stickers, it's got more stuff. And we did one message, and then it's back to SMS. So I feel like this isn't going to happen in the United States. So you're probably right, Om. And it is, and I guess we don't want to all be on the same platform. We want different tools. It just bothers me that I have HipChat, Slack, Line, Wire, Messenger. It feels like Google's missing the boat here. Hangouts could be a unified platform that unifies a lot of people, but they're not making many efforts in that direction.
They were sort of on the cusp of it, and then they walked away from it.
I don't understand Google at all.
If there was like a consumer-y personal version of Slack, that could be really appealing to me. Because
I love Slack.
I'm on Slack all day for work.
You know, I've heard that people actually do use it as consumer. They have Slack groups, and they'll do stuff, and you can have Slack is kind of cool because you can have bots, and it can be elaborate. Every time I type certain phrases, and we use Slack with our web team. And when I type certain phrases into Slack, like Borat shows up. Every time I say something like, nice move, Borat goes, yeah. And just, it's very customizable and very powerful. Maybe that's what's missing, is that there isn't there, that if we all use the same platform, we could all be speaking the same language. I know, you're right, Om. It's old-fashioned. The idea that we used to all watch the same TV show Sunday nights.
Yeah, and now we watch different things, yeah. And it's more fun, and, you know.
We're in a more fragmented world.
We're all unique snowflakes.
Oh, God. I'm just an old one. All right, let's take a break. We're going to come back. I thought you guys would all join me and we could all team up and we could create a movement to all use whatever, but that's, what would it be? I mean, I don't want it to be Facebook. I don't want Facebook to win. I guess that's the problem. I do not want Facebook, because Facebook's already won 1.5 billion monthly active users on the Facebook platform. 300 million on Instagram. What is the WhatsApp? Is it, it's got to be at least that.
How many? 800 million.
Yep. Heading to a billion.
I guess they've already won. If they put a personal assistant, if they put more features into Messenger, could they win? Is it possible to win in the U.S. anyway?
I think their big Messenger would be their play in non-China markets. I don't think they can win in China or some of the other big Asian countries, in Korea or in Japan, but they can. You know, Messenger could be a huge win for them in India, for example. Like, they're massive in India. I think that's where their big numbers are coming from.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. Africa is another place where Messenger could be huge. I think a lot of people don't really realize it, that, you know, WhatsApp got a lot of traction in Africa. You know, BBC used to publish a lot of stories in WhatsApp, and people had created Slack-like groups inside WhatsApp, and BBC used that to cover, elections in both in Nigeria and Kenya. I mean, so, like, you know, these societies are much more mobile first and much more advanced compared to us. So I think if you're looking at Facebook to make an effort, it would be in places like India and in many parts of Africa, some parts of, you know, Latin America where they're massive. I would not be surprised if it becomes a dominant global messaging.
Well, and there's considerable money to be made in banking, yeah. In Africa. M-Pesa
money transfer.
Yeah, it's very successful. Does M-Pesa goes over the text or the messaging network?
Yeah, text messaging. You know, Facebook hired the guy who was running PayPal to lead the messenger effort.
Yeah, David Marcus.
Yeah, David Marcus is leading a huge effort, pushing to commerce inside the messenger platform. So it'd be interesting to see what they can actually achieve. But, you know, it looks pretty promising.
You know, we talk a lot about, you know, the next big thing being virtual reality and stuff like that. Messaging platforms seem like kind of a mundane subject. And yet that seems like there is a battle raging, but kind of between these big companies. And because there's no incumbent, there's no big winner, it's going to be very interesting.
So 20-plus years of covering communications and messaging. So for the longest time, the only way you could monetize messaging was, like in the early days, it was through SMS. When Skype and all came, you essentially bought minutes and like buckets of minutes. But now, you know, with mobile, things have advanced to a level where we can actually start to think about making
commerce
and, yeah, and like not just commerce, like, you know, I'm like, why can't I have a subscription group where I share a link to read an article? If you're a subscriber, you know, just you get the link and it only is available to that group and you read it and you go away after that. And, you know, the only, like, you can't share it, you can't do anything, it's confined to that. I mean, that's what WhatsApp can do. That's what, you know, Slack can do. As I think there's a lot more promise in messaging and communications now. You know, I'm a firm believer in the whole idea of this conversational user interface, the emergence of intelligent bots, which allow us to automate a lot of things we do on the network. I think those are things, you know, they're not too far off. They're like within 12 to, you know, 48 months time frame, we're going to start to see a lot of these services become mainstream.
And, of course, Microsoft is not being counted out here because whether anybody realizes it or not, they are all in on Skype. And in fact, on Windows 10, they've started the movement towards separating Skype messaging into a separate application, just as Facebook did with its messaging. And I think that Microsoft wants to get back into this business. It gave up on MSN Messenger quite famously a few years ago, but I think they want to get back into this. Everybody's looking at this.
The problem with Microsoft is that they kind of get too distracted with making a lot of complex, bringing complex features into their products instead of trying to stay simple. I think, you know, Facebook Messenger is really simple. WhatsApp, really simple. I used to use Line and WeChat, and they were pretty simple, you know, easy to understand on day one. And then, you know, over a period of time, they have taught us new behaviors. So I think it just is very important to not forget how important it is for us to have simple interfaces. You know, Skype is actually a degraded experience. I only have negative feelings about Skype.
You mentioned behavior, and I think that's part of this too, is human behavior is changing. We don't make phone calls as much as we used to, and email has failed us as a way of communicating. I think that email is truly federated, cross-platform, interoperable, and everybody hates it. So it feels like there should be something. In fact, one of the most interesting areas for a new apps has been a new approach to email that is glomming the messaging interface on top of email. Because we do like messaging. So there's something about messaging that fits the way we communicate, and more so. I remember in the early days of text messaging in the U.S., nobody text messaged because you didn't have a smartphone, so you'd have to press, you know, 444-2. Yeah. And then you couldn't message across carriers very well. And I remember seeing TV shows in England where they'd say, you know, SMS us your vote. And it was huge. Everybody was doing it. They were sending billions of messages a week. And it was not existent in the United States. And it was thanks to Apple. I think the iPhone in 2007 changed everything. And now we text message as much as anybody did. All right. We're going to take a break. Come back with more. Om Malik is here from Om.co. One of the great, great observers of the tech industry. Also from Chennai, India, visiting us via Skype. And that's the amazing thing. You're literally on the other side of the world. And we get a great image of Jill Duffy from PC Magazine. It's the middle of the night, but hey, don't hold that against us. Thank you for being here. And sitting in studio with me, Harry McCracken, who actually had probably the biggest ordeal because he had to go through traffic.
Oh.
To get here in MeetSpace. Terrible idea, MeetSpace. Our show today brought to you by GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from the convenience of your computer, your smartphone, your tablet. No one wants to commute across the bridge, through outside lands, drive through Marin, all the way to Sonoma County just to sit face-to-face for a meeting.
Nobody.
Except Harry. It's even worse if you're pitching somebody. I mean, you're not doing them a favor with a face-to-face meeting. Clients and colleagues prefer GoToMeeting. It's easy for them. It's easy for you. With GoToMeeting, you can meet from any computer, any tablet, any smartphone. You can even present from an iPad. And, you know, it's not just screen sharing. Of course, that's how GoToMeeting started, so that you're all on the same page. You can see the same screen. You can show them your PowerPoint, that kind of thing. But now that everybody has a high-quality webcam on their device, they've added HD meeting video. And I love that because now it takes a meeting and makes it a face-to-face meeting, even if you're on opposite sides of the world. I want you to try GoToMeeting today. It's free for 30 days. You don't even need an offer code. Just visit GoToMeeting.com and click the Try It Free button. And I tell you, before the show is over, actually within a minute or two, you'll be set up and having your first meeting. It doesn't take anything. And it's easy for your clients, too. Even if they've never used GoToMeeting, they'll find it simple and fast. I love it. GoToMeeting.com. It transforms a phone call into a really valuable face-to-face meeting. GoToMeeting. A lot of folks in Vegas over the last 10 days for Black Hat and DEF CON. And we talked a little bit with Steve Gibson yesterday on the new screensavers about some of the revelations. Of course, a lot of this was released ahead of time. The things like the car hackings, the Jeep hacking, and the Tesla hackings, and so forth. And we were hoping to learn more at these conferences. And this year, we did not. Not much more from Charlie Miller about the Jeep hacking. I mean, everything we learned about in the Wired article is, you know, true, but not much more. stage fright, which was kind of revealed beforehand. There's still no proof of concept code because nobody wants to help hackers, which is good. Stage Fright is the Android vulnerability that takes advantage of the media player in Android called Stage Fright. Zimperium, which is the group that discovered the Stage Fright virus, has released a detection tool. Although Steve said if you install that on Android, you should also install Lookout's detection tool. And you'll get a second opinion. I put it on my up-to-date, late model, brand new Google phone, the Nexus 6, running Google Fi, and I'm vulnerable. So if I'm vulnerable, we're all screwed. Because, I mean, what about somebody with a really old phone? There's not going to be any update. Although LG, Samsung, and Google have all agreed to start a monthly update cycle. That's probably an improvement.
Amazing it took this many years for them to do that.
There are attacks in the wild, stage fright attacks in the wild, although I don't know how dangerous they are. Google has pointed out that because it is using address space relocation in all versions of Android since Jelly Bean, that it's not really a issue of somebody getting control of your phone on those more recent versions of Android. But there are literally something like 800 or 900 million Android phones that are vulnerable to this. We also learned that hackers can remotely steal fingerprints from Android phones. That's a little bit scary. Have you looked into how this works? This was announced at Black Hat on Wednesday by FireEye.
Yeah, apparently, I mean, on an iPhone, your fingerprint is encrypted and it's stored in this walled off part of the phone. I assume that the same was true with Android.
I thought so, but apparently not.
Apparently not. And of course, on Android, different manufacturers are implementing fingerprint scanning in different ways. So there is not one company in charge of making it safe.
The attack was confirmed on the HTC One Max and Samsung's Galaxy S5. A hacker could, without your knowledge, acquire the fingerprint images from the device. The sensor is not locked down. It doesn't even require root privileges. So that's bad.
You find a 1997 phone.
You know, just Commander Adamo is right with the Galactica. You just, everything should be wired and old. And then we'd all be safe.
That's why people love watching your show. Wired and old and safe.
Oh, what did I ever do to you? No, it's
because I've missed you.
It comes from love. You feel love. There's deep. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
It's a joke.
Let's see. Did you see the GOP debate? By the way, the highest rated cable news show of all time.
Take that, Kardashians.
Huh?
Kardashians have nothing on our.
Oh, yeah. No. This is better than screw Kardashians. We've got Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Were they talking about it in India, Jill?
I saw some of my U.S. friends commenting about the debates, obviously, on Facebook. I didn't watch them live, obviously. I kind of read some of the recaps. I think the most interesting thing from the international perspective is to see how early these debates start in the United States. So there was
yeah, we got 18 months for the till the election.
There was like some blowback in Canada because the candidates started campaigning. It was something like 15 weeks before the election, and people were out. It was like, you know, the holiday decorations came up before Halloween or something.
Oh, yeah.
It was like people were outraged, and then you look at what happens in the U.S. and it's just so crazy.
You know, if you're going to spend $1.5 billion to get elected president, you got to start early. It's not easy to put that all that money. Speaking of India, Google is planning to bring Android One back in India with a sub-$50 device. This is part of the problem. It's funny because simultaneously as the stage fright story, you see stories like this. And this is part of the problem that Google has, which is that a lot of these very low-cost phones just are never going to get updated. And there's no way to update them. And yet, this is, I think, important to everybody to get people online and using computers.
And the idea with Android One is to do a phone which is really cheap, but is also a respectable phone
right.
for the price, and one where it's not going to be based on an ancient version of Android, and it stands a chance of getting updated.
It's not ancient now, but it'll be ancient in 4 years, and then you have the same problem. Although I think Google's moving a lot of the system components out of the system and into the Play Store, so that they
update. They're trying to do current versions of Android, which right. are small enough to run on a phone that can be sold for a price like $50.
It's interesting. Verizon announced that they're joining this week that they're joining T-Mobile in eliminating subsidies for smartphones. So all of a sudden, people in the United States are seeing what that smartphone actually costs. It's not $200. An iPhone, $700. Many of the top of the line phones are between $600 and $800. And I think that's going to add pressure to reduce phone costs here in the States, even. In fact, the new phones that we're seeing, the Moto X, the Moto G, the OnePlus 2, are all sub $500. I think that's telling, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's more bad news for everybody except Apple, essentially. I think Apple will still be able to sell a flagship phone at a flagship price, but I think it will be a challenge for Samsung. And if you're HTC or LG or anybody else, it gets tougher and tougher to do a $700 phone and get people to buy it.
Yeah.
It'll still work as long as there's a payment plan system, right? So part of the issue is that people have decided how much they're willing to pay for a mobile phone monthly, right? They've kind of been anchored into a price, and that price can be anywhere from about, I'd say, $45, $50 to about $100, right? And if you're saying, okay, upfront, I need to pay $800 now and enroll in a plan, people are not going to go for that. But if you can work out the numbers one way or another to make it a monthly payment based on what people are ready to pay, I think it can still work.
With Verizon, it's pretty confusing because some people are going to end up paying more under the new plan, and some are going to end up paying less.
And people with existing Verizon accounts are not going to get any change at all, which is going to be very confusing.
I mean, in theory, this could be really good if it involves the price you pay for your service no longer have the price that Verizon needs to pay for all those phones it's subsidizing in there. Because historically, you've gotten a subsidized phone, and you've paid a price with the subsidy built in, but you've continued paying that subsidized service charge even after you've paid off your phone.
Right.
And it's become pure profit for Verizon.
Is this pressure from T-Mobile? Why is Verizon even?
This is clearly T-Mobile's strategy working. I think they're changing the game. They're making things work more effectively in favor of the consumer and using that as an advantage to steal market share away from Verizon. So definitely there is an upside to the whole thing right now. You know, the one thing I wonder, like, where the future is headed is the sticker you have on your laptop, the Google Fi sticker, the Project Fi.
Yeah.
I think, you know, as we speak less and less on the phone, data becomes more important. You're going to start to see many more experiments like Google Fi start to emerge, and that's where the next battleground is going to be. So that's why also, you know, I look at what T-Mobile and Verizon is actually preparing for the reality of tomorrow, not today. I think tomorrow, I mean, if I can get, you know, $100 for data only on my phone, that's all I want, I'll be very happy. Like, I would be much more happier getting a phone number or SMS and data, and because
I never use the phone anymore.
Yeah, and whenever I do, I'm actually calling through Viber or
right.
WhatsApp, or sometimes even from Skype, and even, you know, Google Voice. So it just is not that important. The phone part of the phone is not important at all. And the text messaging is very important, and even that is becoming less relevant. What we need is just a data connection. I think that's why it makes sense for these guys to get away from, you know, subsidizing the phone itself.
Well, in fact, T-Mobile, the most popular plan among the geeks is a kind of a hidden pay-as-you-go plan on the T-Mobile webpage. $30 a month for unlimited text and data, and only 100 minutes of calling a month. And I tell you what, I'd easily do that for me. I never do more than 100 minutes. Google Fi is $20 for the texting, and by the way, I'm holding the Fi phone up because I suckerly fell for it. $20 a month for texting and phone, unlimited. And then you pay $10 a gigabyte for data. So that's the only upside for Google is the more data you use, the more you'll pay. But it uses the T-Mobile network and the Sprint network and Wi-Fi if you happen to have Wi-Fi handy. I don't really understand, though. This is not – for somebody who's using the $30 T-Mobile plan, this is not a savings. So I'm not sure – again, I don't feel like Google's strategy is clear. Maybe I'm missing the boat.
Yeah, I have like 15 gigabytes, and I'm not paying $150 for that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm intrigued by the Google Fi. Now that I'm a civilian, I'm still waiting for my phone to show up. So I haven't tried it.
Yeah.
But I look at that, and I just said, this is interesting because I can get 3G when I'm traveling worldwide, which is great.
Yeah.
And it also allows me to not worry about which platform I'm on, T-Mobile or Sprint. Not exactly the rock solid networks, but good enough. And Wi-Fi, I think this is where we are headed. Like maybe not this exact model, but this is where we are headed, where we see all the carriers getting abstracted on our devices. I think it's not as crazy to think about the future, service like device coming with. Okay, you turn it on, you don't have to think about who you are signing up with, that just is the network. And in the background, stuff happens. I think this is, not today, but in the future. You look at what companies like Comcast and Cox and Time Warner are doing. They're setting up their own massive Wi-Fi clouds everywhere, right? So you suddenly start to think, it's like, what is the idea of connectivity going forward? It's not the way we've always assumed it is. Right, so which is just a phone, sign up with the phone company, give them $150 a month, and basically you're locked into a 3-year contract. It makes no sense anymore.
It's also driving the size of the phones. If you're not making phone calls on it, you want the biggest screen you can get because that's better for typing and surfing and computing, which is what you're doing mostly with phones these days. So Motorola's new phones are big. Samsung's new phones are big. Everybody's got, and this phone is ridiculous. It's 6 inches.
I have iPhone 6 Plus, and I have a 1999 version Samsung flip phone. I paid $29 to Verizon for my flip phone to make phone calls. That's it.
Oh, that's funny.
Because it's impossible to make phone calls on these big phones. you have to have headphones, and it just is too complex. You can't, you have to do too many things while you're using the phone. So it just is better to get a simple, voice phone. I like the comfort of a flip phone. It actually sounds cleaner and clearer, and there's no GPS chip on the damn thing. So it's all good.
It's a burner.
Yeah.
Jill, did you get a new phone when you moved to India? What did you do?
No, I just got a SIM card. So I had an unlocked phone and I got a local SIM card, and that seems to work fine for me. But the majority of phone calls I take, actually, this is my setup. So I have a headset.
Right.
And I use my computer. I use Google Voice often. So when I have meetings with companies in the United States, I always want to give them a U.S. phone number. So I still use Google Voice, which is not the best system, I have
to
say.
Does it work in India?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize it.
I used to live in the UK, too, and I used it a lot there for the same reason, to give people a U.S. phone number. But the convenience of just having a U.S. phone number is huge, and you don't have to pay for it with Google Voice the way that you could with Skype to get a phone number. But my setup is, I'm usually at my desk. My phone calls are always planned. I don't take impromptu phone calls. Nobody ever calls
me. I don't either.
Just to say
hello. If somebody rings my phone, I ignore it.
It's weird.
Right.
That's you, too?
A phone call is startling. Like a plan. It's like a meeting. So I'm usually in my home. I have my setup. I have my headphones. I'm often recording the call. And that's what phone means to me now.
Right. But I'm not doing any reporting. And I notice I still go to my desktop computer, put on my headset before I make a phone call because it's just more comfortable. I don't want to be holding the phone. And this is only useful for emergencies, basically. And I only answer the phone if it's my friends or family, mostly just family, because I don't have any friends.
Family over the age of 70 in a lot of cases.
Yeah, right. Right. It's an emergency thing, right? Because my kids aren't making phone calls. They're texting me. Behavior's changed.
Speaking of emergencies, I have an article coming out tomorrow, Monday morning on PC Mag, about putting emergency contact information into your phone. So this was something, as I started to look at the different phones and the ways to do it, Apple is definitely ahead. It has the easiest system. So
don't they have an app for that?
It's in the health app.
That's right.
There's every phone has to allow you to make an emergency call from the lock screen.
Right.
This is a requirement in the U.S. So Apple has a little button that has medical information on it. And I really highly recommend everybody who has an Apple device use that. If you have kids, if kids are going away to college soon, absolutely make sure they set it up. It takes about 2 minutes to do, but it has your name, your medical information, as much as you want to put in there. So allergies, blood type, and as many contacts as you want to list as your emergency ID people. So it's important not only for us to set it up, but also for other people to know how to access it.
And does that show up if you make an emergency call from the lock screen?
So when you swipe from the lock screen and you hit emergency call, you then get a dialer, and you also see on the bottom a little thing that says medical ID, and that's where you pull it up.
So that's if I have a heart attack and I fall to the ground and somebody grabs my phone, they can actually call for help and have that information right there.
Hopefully they know about that.
So for Android, it's not as good because there's a lot of apps that offer this. It's not on all phones. There are some phones that have it in the settings, but it's fragmented. It's Android. But the trick with Android is to find an app that offers it with a widget from the lock screen. So
that's what I need. Yeah.
Do it. Yeah. And they're a lot of them are buggy. Some of them mess with your alarm apparently. And then I looked at BlackBerry and Windows Phone, and they're not as good either. I think there's an app for both of those that allow you to put any message you want on your lock screen. So again, I recommend to people put your emergency contact info there.
Jason Howell, have you found anything? Jason not only is my producer, but the host of All About Android and Android App Arena. Have you found any good emergency information apps for Android? Are you aware of this?
Specifically, I mean, I know that there are plenty of apps that do that on the lock screen, like Jill's talking about. The problem there is that Lollipop and beyond, there are no more lock screen widgets. Oh. They basically got rid of that, and now it's the notification stream there by default. So that helps you if you're, plenty of people are on older versions of Android, as we know. Well, not too well. But yeah, current versions, Lollipop and more recent, don't have that ability. So should be built in by
default. Should be.
It absolutely should.
The irony is, I don't know if everybody knows this is on the Apple lock screen.
Yeah.
I guess first responders probably have been told this, right?
I would hope so. the other life hack way to do it is to create a note in any note-taking app. Make sure it's centered. Type your emergency contact info there. Take a screenshot of it. Make that your wallpaper.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
But then it's always there.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's an EMT. I am going to ask him, do you know about this? Is this common knowledge among first responders? How about in the chat room? Any first responders in the chat room? I bet you this is the kind of thing. I remember dimly Apple announcing this, probably at WWDC or one of the conferences. But I forgot that this is even in there. I'm glad you wrote that article, Jill.
I didn't know it was in there.
You didn't either. No, see? And Om and I, who are old men.
No, I definitely need that.
Well, you've actually, in all seriousness, you've had a heart attack.
Yeah, I'm glad I actually came on the show. I learned something new.
How did you, when you had your heart attack, was that in public? Where did that happen?
It was at home.
And you knew that you were having a heart attack?
Hell no. I thought I was having heartburn.
Yeah.
Like I had a certain specific kind of food the night before, and I assume I was having heartburn because of that. And, you know, I figured out later, thanks to a friend who did the diagnosis, you know, who diagnosed me while I was telling him on the phone how I felt. I guess his father was a cardiologist, and he had paid attention to what was going on. And he came over and took me to the hospital.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That is one thing my EMT friend has told me.
with both stroke and heart attack, getting a person to the hospital is as quickly as possible is hugely important. In fact, I remember reading a New York Times article last month that they've had something like 18% improvement in heart attack recovery, not through any medical procedure, but because they got people to the hospital faster. That the they have EKGs in the ambulance now. They can send that to the hospital before you get there, so that they're ready when you arrive. The other thing he told me, and this is important for everybody to hear, is if you think you're having a heart attack, don't drive yourself. Get to the hospital. He said, don't be embarrassed. We're very used to this. People coming in with gas and anxiety and thinking it's a heart attack. It's not a shameful thing. We're very used to it. And we'd far prefer you came in than that you ignored the symptoms. Because it can really save your life. He told me, I can't remember what it was, but every minute there's a certain percentage. Every minute that goes by, a certain percentage less life expectancy or something. I can't remember the exact thing. Anyway, we'll move on. But I'm glad you made it, Om. And I'm glad you have a good friend who was there to...
Me too.
Get you to...
I'm pretty happy about that.
Yeah. Yeah. More to come in a bit. Om Malik is back, baby. So you said you don't travel in the summer because that's the amateurs do that.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that true?
Oh, it is. Plus, it's hot.
Also, the airport's so crowded.
Yeah.
So crowded.
So where are you going next and when? Because I'd like to raid your apartment. It looks like you got some good stuff in there.
Yeah, you can try.
Oh, you have some booby traps? You got some secret stuff?
Dude, I'm going to have videos of you coming in on Drop Cam. I mean, that just is like 10 million views right there.
You'll never believe. Leo broke into my apartment, and you'll never believe what happened next.
What happened next? That will be the headline on
It's Buzz. A hit. That's a million views right there.
That's right.
Also visiting us, who knew? A couple of months ago, she moved to India. We're so glad, though, that you would be on the show with us, even though it's early, early morning. Jill Duffy from PC Mag. Great to have you.
I don't know if you can hear, but I'm starting to hear some birds chirping outside, some parrots walking.
The morning has come. Morning has broken. Harry McCracken and I are going to do a little performance here. The technologizer from fastcompany.com, Harry McCracken. Somebody got mad at me the last time you were on. He said he's not the technologizer anymore.
No, I will always be.
You're always going to be.
I'm honored you remember.
You're forever the technologizer.
But I write at Fast Company. So.
Yeah, not at technologizer.com.
Don't go to technologizer.com to read my new stuff. Go to Fast Company.
But do you maintain that? You put stuff up
every once in a great while, I'll write on technologizer, but it's been several months.
It's so sad what's happened to blogging. I'm proud of Om for maintaining, keeping this alive.
This is an old man thing. Man.
It's for old men. No blog for old men.
Yeah.
Om.co, which is, by the way, one of the most beautiful designs ever. It's just simple and clean and yes.
No design.
What?
There's no design.
There's no design. That's the design. Yeah. There's no design.
Yeah.
That's why it's so good.
It's good. No ads.
No ads either. Well, we'll talk about ads in just a second.
Yeah.
There's a lot of news in the online advertising world. Our show today brought to you by Braintree. If you're a mobile app developer, you know that, and you want to have payments in there, you know that, of course, you're good. You could write it yourself, but don't. In fact, one of the biggest mistakes people make is doing their own e-commerce, their own crypto, their own security. Braintree makes it so easy. 10 lines of code. It's funny, who was I talking to? A mobile app developer who said, That was the phrase that got me. 10 lines of code, and you can accept Apple Pay. You can accept credit cards, Venmo, PayPal, all kinds of payments. Easy as pie. You can even accept Bitcoin if you want in your app. We talked to the CTO of Braintree, great guy, Juan Benitez, about the feedback, the kind of feedback he's getting from developers about Braintree. Listen.
You know, when we talk to iOS engineers, they get really excited by how fast and easy it is to have Apple Pay through Braintree. Just a ton of feedback from Android developers saying, wow, great, now I can get Android Pay. Then you see people really kind of responding and saying, wow, I can do more than one of these through one integration, one SDK, and one report too. Wow, that's going to make my finance guys happy.
Fast payouts, superior fraud protection, great customer service. It's easy for the developer, and it, as he said, it makes the finance guys and gals really happy. Now, just look at who uses Braintree, and you'll get an idea of how great this is. Airbnb uses it. So does Hotels Tonight. Uber uses it. Now, if there were one company where mobile payment experience is premier, is the entire story, it'd be Uber. Yes, that's Braintree. So does Lyft. Lyft uses it too. In fact, GitHub started with Braintree, and they're still doing it. From your first dollar to your billionth, there is no better way. You're going to like it. I think Uber's using that one-touch product that makes it so easy. A full-stack payment solution ready for you. You can try it in the sandbox. And as a little sweetener, if you go to BraintreePayments.com/twit, we're going to get you your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. BraintreePayments.com/twit. Tell your boss, whoever makes the decisions, that's the product. Braintree. I'm just looking at emergency information. Here's an Android. You fill it out. Yeah, you know, there isn't really any good. Jill, did you make a recommendation in your article for something?
Yeah, there's one. ICE is usually the word, right?
ICE.
Increase of emergency, right?
ICE.
So if you search for ICE, there's usually a few that come up. I don't remember off the top of my head, but there's one that costs about $399 that was widely used but seemed to cause bugs for some people.
From App
but again, if it's offered in your settings, and everybody should check with their particular phone and their particular carrier, if it's offered in your settings, that's really where you want to be implementing it.
Awesome. You know, this is something Google could put into Android and probably should.
Some people in chat were saying that it's in there in settings, but I don't know if that's Google specific. By default or it's if it's like, I have a Samsung phone. And it's in my settings.
I think that's phone specific. I don't see it on my Nexus 6.
Yeah, I was looking at mine as well. I couldn't find it.
I guess we haven't done any Apple stories. I probably it wouldn't be a twit without some Apple stories, right? Apple apparently, according to John Pechkowski, king of the Apple leak, he's rapidly eclipsing Mark Gurman. Now that Patch, I'm going to call him Patch. I don't know if anybody else calls him Patch.
Good old Patch.
Good old Patch. Now that Patch is at BuzzFeed, he's still getting the scoops. He says Apple's fall iPhone event will be September 9th.
Although the actual story says the week of the 7th, probably the 9th.
Yeah. Sometime in the 7th, could be the 8th, could be the 9th. Apple had the usually holds its events on Tuesdays, which would make the 8th, if you ask me, the more likely of the two. We don't know what they will announce, but it is September, so it likely is a new iPhone, right?
He says iPhones, iPads, and Apple TV.
Wow.
So the whole shebang.
So no October event. Just get it all done with.
Well, maybe just one event this time.
Apple TV is one of those things Pechkowski has been talking about since June, since WWDC. Supposedly, it was going to be announced at the Worldwide Developers Conference. Apple backed out, probably because they couldn't make the deals with the networks and the local TV stations they wanted to make. I don't know if they've made those deals. It may be that they finally just said, oh, screw it. If we don't release this now, we'll never release it. And they'll hope the deals will come. Apple would like for the Apple TV to be the ultimate cord-cutting device. Will it be, Ohm?
I hope so.
You like it?
I don't have a television, so...
You have to cord-cut.
You look in the back. I haven't had a TV since 2008. We had a website called New TV, which was all around the idea of online television, cord-cutting, and everything. So I said I should live the lifestyle if I'm... going to start a blog about that.
And Yanko Rutgers was the one of your great reporters. He's now at Variety.
Yeah, he's one of the more amazing people I had a chance to work with, and Liz Gaines, who she was the founding editor of that site. And
love Chris Liz. Albright, so, she's at Recode.
Yeah, I think she's doing some research now at Stanford.
Oh, really? Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's right. She's retired to become a student.
Yeah. And it's great to not have television. And so you can actually experience the whole no screen kind of life. But when I go and see some of my friends who are using Apple TV, you can see the potential. I actually really like Chromecast. I think Chromecast is.
I do too.
It's a very well-made product from Google, which doesn't do too many products finished and, you know, completed like the way they've done with Chromecast. I also like Roku. I think Roku is a interesting little company. They keep going. And so I like the whole category per se, because I believe that, you know, I think the whole idea of television the way it was is just makes no sense anymore. I think, you know, I felt that way in 2008, and I still feel it. You know, it's finally last 1 week, you're beginning to see everybody talk about the reality of cord cutting. So sometimes, you know, it takes 5 to 7 years for reality to happen. But it's been fun. Like, the iPad is a great viewing device from my standpoint. I watch MLB on it. I watch cricket on it. I watch NBA on it. So it's like it's like a very small television. But the Apple TV, if it comes out, it will actually push more and more people to think about just using that as an interface for consuming content.
This week, Wall Street cut $60 billion off the value of major media companies based on this kind of cord-cutting fear. Somebody, who was it, was talking at a conference and said...
ESPN.
It was ESPN. Their revenues are down for the first time.
It sounds like the TV business is finally acknowledging that cord-cutting might impact their business over the long term, which until recently they were in real fierce denial mode about.
Well, it's confusing because you read these statistics. ESPN, which is traditionally the cable channel people will pay the most for, they make the most money, something like $6.25 per subscriber. For them to make less is a big deal. But then you also hear statistics, people are watching more broadcast television than ever before. So I don't know which is true, but obviously media stocks really took a hit. Walt Disney, 21st Century Fox, and Viacom, although the CEO of Cablevision said, not so fast, it's not that bad. We don't see, he told the Wall Street Journal, we don't see a landslide of cord cutting in the near term. James Dolan. Now, of course, he's talking to investors,
right?
So he's trying to shore up the stock. He says, I don't think the sky is falling quite yet. Nevertheless, Cablevision shares fell 2.7% on Friday and 5% over the 2 days.
Leo, the key way to think about any of these changes is we are beginning to see a whole generation think about television not as television, but something on demand. And then you have a generation behind them who think of video only in terms of devices, which they can hold in their hand and they can touch.
I think that's exactly right.
And so 10 years forward, you know, these guys may, you know, stem the losses for a little while, do some financial engineering. 10 years down the line, the behavior of the consumer is very different. That's when, you know, it's not cord cutting. It just is a different behavior.
They're not watching television at all.
Yeah, yeah. And I think this whole notion that, you know, live sports is going to save their bacon and live events, I don't know. We don't know, like, what the consumers of tomorrow are going to, you know, adapt to these things or not. Like, I don't know. I am really interested in trying to figure out how people consume television in the next 5 years to actually make a reasonable call on, like, what the future looks like. But this one thing is for sure, the way things were, that's gone. Like that, you know, $60 billion or $600 billion in their market cap, that just is irrelevant. These companies have been sitting and doing absolutely nothing, and that's why they are beginning to suffer.
Well, cable, you know, companies first, and then networks next. I mean, I think the networks are in denial about the fact that people aren't even watching TV. Go ahead, Jill. I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's been some really great stories about MLB, which was one of the first leaders, I think, in getting to the online space. So the MLB TV people, Major League Baseball, were really trying to offer some kind of online experience early on. They knew that they had a worldwide audience of people watching baseball who couldn't always watch it because they didn't have U.S. network television. So in the early days of MLB TV, it was awful. It was like watching a pixelated video game, you know, frame by frame. It was terrible. But they stuck with it and they developed it out. And we're an MLB household, so we use it quite frequently. But
at 3 in the morning, unfortunately.
We have actually, I have to start the game because I'm allowed to see the final scores.
Ah.
So I'm in charge of starting the game.
I see.
But yeah, after the fact. But what happened was HBO hired some people from MLB who had worked on
right.
that product.
HBO Now was HBO. Based in MLB.
Now,
yeah,
exactly. And they said, we really need somebody who has expertise. And nobody had any expertise.
Including yet. Their own giant in-house, very expensive HBO Go team up there in Seattle.
Right.
Well,
except
left.
For the MLB people. So I think, and I think HBO has been a huge story this year. Yeah. Once they offered that a la carte service, that's going to be a real, I think it's going to set the tone for a lot of other channels.
ESPN went over the top with Sling TV.
I think Sling has been a big deal. And I think we'll look back at Sling as having been really important.
Yeah. Yet I think the real problem is exactly his own points. And I have two kids, 23 and 21. The 23-year-old will watch Netflix, she'll sit down in front of a TV set. She's a cord cutter in that sense. She's not watching live programming. She's watching on-demand programming off the internet. The 21-year-old won't do that. He watches YouTube, and that's it. And I feel like that's really, I mean, you're missing the boat if you're thinking, oh, the next thing is over the top. As I think you nailed it, which is TV watching itself has changed completely, and people are using mobile devices. They're not watching TV. They're consuming content in some completely different way.
I think what it does is it basically all the economics of our television and entertainment ecosystem is built on mass audience. Right.
Right.
And we are going into more, like fractional audience over a long period of time. And there will be hits and there will be some people who will do really well with the hits, like, HBO and True Detective or Sopranos type of shows will succeed.
You think there's a future for that kind of programming, that kind of event programming?
Absolutely. I think great storytelling is great storytelling.
Yeah.
Whether you tell them through, you tell them as a poem or you tell them as a movie or as a, running TV series. Great stories are great stories. There will be far, the focus has to be on finding that interesting thing that people are glued to. But most of the viewing is going to be fractional. So the economics of the industry changes not from mass audience, which is like mass audience, put lots of television, charge lots of money and go home. Whereas fractional is, everything is just, up for grabs. Maybe we need to be thinking really, really hard about paid content, subscription models, which are entirely different than what they are today. I think Netflix works because it is actually an interesting business model, not because it has the best content. It's like they figured out that for $10 a month, people are okay putting up with, a lot of average content as long as they find something to see on a daily basis.
We don't really care as long as there's colors and people moving. It doesn't really matter what it is.
But think about it this way. How much time do you have in your day anymore to watch television?
Right.
Like, let's take what's happening in our society right now. If you don't have full-time jobs in the middle class, people are going to work 2, 3, 4 jobs. They're going to do, right, to make ends meet. They're not watching television. They will watch television within, all these things they're doing and finding. We'll have to steal time to entertain ourselves.
Does that mean short form is going to be more successful?
Not like 2-minute videos, definitely. But I'm sure, there will be, somebody might come up with a new format.
It's hard to tell a story. In fact, you're seeing really the opposite when you think about the fact that these HBO shows like Game of Thrones or True Detective really are 30 or 40-hour movies. They're not even 2-hour movies. They're spread out, but they're a lot of hours. We've gotten better at a long story arc than ever before. We like those long stories.
How about like a 2-hour news screensavers?
It is 2 hours, as a matter of fact.
Well, it feels like it's like half hour.
Good. I like it. Thank you, Om. Rock on.
You know, when you start to look at some of the TV shows that are coming out exclusive on Vimeo and YouTube, I think they're breaking away from the idea of having a format at all. They say, let us tell the story in the amount of time that we need.
Oh, good.
So shows like High Maintenance, for example, which is on Vimeo, and there's a few others that have very short programs. I think that's a good experimental way to go, but I think we also have to remember that we've been programmed to consume content in certain blocks. So a half hour show is usually actually somewhere between 22 and 26 minutes in the US because of commercial breaks. And if you watch on Netflix, right, like you'll watch those 22 minutes straight through. And then there's a difference between an hour long show on network, which is usually about 46 minutes, and an hour long HBO show, which is actually more like 58, 59 minutes. And I think we're acclimated to watching in those breaks, and that writers start to get used to writing in those breaks, right? So you have 14 minutes until your plot twist, and you have 8 minutes of resolution. You know what I mean? So I think we have some forms that are more ingrained in our behavior for consuming media than we realize. And I would say the same thing about movies too. So you know that the movie studios are pushing for a certain amount of time on a movie because they know that the consumer going to the theater wants a certain length of an experience to feel like they're getting their money's worth. So writers are taught to pace their stories based on that block of time that they're given. So I think some of those issues are going to be harder to overcome in new media. I think new media helps them a lot, but I think getting used to the idea that we, the consumer, want to have certain things happen in our story, in the plotting and the pacing, just because we've been accustomed to that's the way that a story is
told. It might even be biological. Ira Glass says that there's a natural of This American Life, says there's a natural beat structure that's almost built into our biology of, I think it's 45 seconds. He has a whole talk he does about this natural structure. You know what comes to mind? This is very similar to our conversation about messaging earlier, which is essentially that we're moving into a fragmented world where there are lots of different flavors, and you pick the flavor that suits you. I'm looking at High Maintenance. It's interesting. This is on Vimeo. It's a series. Have you watched this, Jill? It's a series.
Yeah, I've seen a little bit of it. It's
$1.99 an episode. It's just the same as like a real TV show.
Yeah.
It is a real TV show.
But it's on Vimeo.
Yeah, so that doesn't mean anything. Right?
I guess you're right. And Wiz in our chat room keeps saying, you guys are missing the point. It's about cost. The cable companies are charging us so much, we're just trying to save money. I don't think that's the case.
I think that is the case,
it
too,
is.
Right? They keep charging for things we don't want.
Yeah, you know, totally.
People will happily pay for things they want, right?
It's much like the music industry selling you an album when you only wanted one song.
Yeah. Except it's
as
like,
soon as you can go a la carte, you will.
It's like 100 channels you will never, ever watch. At least if you buy
an album,
it's all by the same person.
I do think we're willing to pay for our content, though. You know what I'm saying? I think that people don't want free content. If it's good content, I think people will pay for Game of Thrones. HBO Now, as far as I can tell, is a success, right?
I mean, HBO is doing well because it's set the standard so very high that people are willing to pay for it.
Well, not everybody can be HBO or New York Times, right? Let's be very clear.
Well, that's the scarcity, is talent.
Right. Yeah.
The scarcity is writing and acting.
I think HBO has done a great job of maintaining quality and being very clear about what they stand for. I think New York Times has done a good job so far, but I see that they're starting to go down this path.
It's stumbling.
That they're starting to miss out who they really are and why we are willing to pay for them. I think that's the other thing. You know, the thing which we have never talked about, or like people don't talk about, is like how storytelling it will actually be different going forward because the technology is different, right? So, you know, Jill was talking about 26-minute blocks or 58-minute blocks, but think about it this way. Today, we can stop and have a video sync to another screen at any time. Like, so we don't watch, like, I have not sat down and watched a single movie, you know, end to end. Like, I just maybe watched 10 minutes there and 15 minutes there.
No, you're right. Interstellar, right, which I watched in the theater, was interminable in the theater, but we watched it over 3 nights again, and it was great.
Right?
Three chunks.
Yeah. And And that's where the storytelling is different, right? That's where the idea of what is video content is different. You know, the idea of television, as we know it, doesn't make any sense because we are in full control of how we experience it, right? How we experience it defines what is going to happen to the medium. And it is not going to be a mass medium as a result of that. And I think most of the television industry misses the point about that, completely misses the point that we are in charge. Like, we mean the end customer is in charge of how. That's the beauty. I think people talk about cord cutting. DVR was the most disruptive thing that happened to television.
Yes, as soon as you didn't have to watch it live, everything changed. And you could pause it. And let's not forget, you could skip commercials. Mm-hmm. And that's a big issue for advertisers. And the monetization. Do you think we're going to go paywall? Everything will be for pay, that the idea of free advertising-supported media is threatened by this, Ohm?
I don't know. I mean,
say no, because that's what we're doing here today.
Okay, no.
I knew I should go into that preaching thing. I really feel like that. I missed the bet.
Yeah. I think you're doing a good job, though.
Of preaching?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, if there's a threat, the through line through all of this is that the technology is completely disruptive. What's really interesting is human behavior is as much disrupted as the business models. Business models have to accommodate these new human behaviors, and it's hard. It's a moving target. I love using my kids as an example, but I watched them go from when we were teenagers, we were on the phone while we did our homework. I watched my daughter be on Instant Messenger while she was doing her homework with music playing, to watching my son be on a multiple conference call with Skype while he's doing his homework. I mean, and that's in a couple of years. It's changing so rapidly. I don't blame NBC and Viacom and ESPN, Disney for having some trouble figuring out what the hell we want and where it's all going.
And by the time they do figure it out, we'll want something else.
You know what I want? I want a $25,000 Panama hat, but I'm not getting it.
Why not?
Did you see that amazing story today in the New York Times about the best Panama hat ever made? Was it the Times? I think it was. Mm. No, it was. It wasn't the Times. It was New York Magazine.
You should totally get it.
Panama hat.
Look up Panama hat. There's one last guy.
The world's finest Panama
hat.
Who will buy it?
Yep, and NPR. Who will buy it? It's NPR. Sorry. Great. See, and by the way, that's another point. You don't know where you read the story anymore.
In Ecuador.
Nobody even goes to the front page of the New York Times. You deep link everything, right? Yeah, this guy, he's never going to do it again. He's woven one, the last one, and there nobody knows how to make these anymore. They're fake Panama hats with bleached, and they're that. But this is like 800 thread count.
One of his lesser hats went for $25,000.
Yeah, to a movie star who wanted it for his honeymoon. But they don't even know what this one's worth, because there'll never be another like it. I don't know how I got on that.
He's like the Stradivarius of Panama hats.
The Stradivarius, thank you, of Panama hats.
Impressive.
Can I bring up one other thing about the Apple event?
Oh, yeah, please. Would you? Thank you.
I have my fingers crossed they're going to announce a large-screen iPad, which I'm personally very excited about.
The iPad Pro.
Yeah, they're like the 12.9.
You notice Pechkowski kind of implied that might not happen.
It sounded like he's leaning against that.
And yeah.
You would think that if it was happening, we might have seen more supply chain leaks.
No leaks at all. There was also a rumor that they would do a new mini, iPad mini, that looked a lot like the iPad Air 2. But no supply chain leaks on that either. In fact, the only supply chain leak I've seen is iPhone 6S screens. I mean,
the clearest sign they might be doing a large screen iPad is the stuff they're doing with iOS 9 with the multiple apps on one screen,
right,
and stuff that sounds like it's very productivity oriented,
right,
and would serve you very well if you were trying to use an iPad more like a PC. So I'm holding out hope, but I'm not all that hopeful that it's going to happen within the next few weeks.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, because one of the few new features in the iPhone is Force Touch. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that is a failed technology. That force is just touch. Force touch. It may kind of make sense on the watch because there's not that many things you can do. But I have had force touch now on a couple of Mac laptops. It's unintuitive. You never know what's going to happen when you click it. Apps don't support it. Apple supports it, but it's still unclear. And it gets in the way. Things like clicking and dragging. You press too hard. Now suddenly you're doing something completely different. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's a flop. And no one cares. Which proves my
point. I don't even know what you're talking about.
Exactly. Proves my point. Not only is it a flop, Ohm never even heard of it.
I do have to say, Harry, you should try the new MacBook.
I love my MacBook.
Yeah. I like that too. But,
Do you love that? Do you love that, Ohm?
I absolutely love it.
And you don't know what Force Touch is?
Never used it.
That's one of the key features of the new MacBook.
If the new MacBook had built an LTE, I'd be more excited about it.
Yeah, it's odd that it doesn't. But the new Chromebook Pixel doesn't either. This seems like that should be.
I seem to be the only person who likes it.
I think you have to think about the MacBook as an accessory for your iPhone. That's
and
why
Tether.
Nowhere.
And Tether.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a really nice MacBook. Yeah.
There is a real hit. That MacBook, I was not confident I would like it because of the short key travel. It's just the right size. That is a beautiful screen. And I can live with the keyboard. It's not perfect, but I can live with the keyboard. But here you are with your iPad and your silly little...
And I just realized I started doing it at about the time that Steve Jobs left us because I was in Japan when that happened at a tech show. So it's been 4 years almost.
Oh, wow. That's a long time.
Mostly iPad, yeah.
Yeah. But couldn't you see yourself with a MacBook right there in front of you?
I have an Air, which I love and use a lot. And usually if I'm sitting at a desk at work, I will frequently use my Air.
You know what? You know when I decided to get the MacBook, when I saw that all the... You know, the Kevin Roses and the Ohm Maleks of the world were all using them. And I thought, well, this must be something.
Really?
Yeah.
We look at you for you.
Well, then it's a feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a break. Come back with more. Lots more to talk about. A little more Apple news before we go. But first, I want to tell you about Stamps.com. I haven't talked about Stamps in a long time. I think you all know, but I hope you all know about Stamps.com. This means you no longer go to the post office. That is awesome. And I'm not talking a postage meter. Postage meters are terrible. That's so 1980s. They're expensive. You have multi-year commitments. The ink, there's hidden fees. They change the postal rates. You have to pay to get the postage meter updated. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the modern way, Stamps.com. It's software. It's web-based. You can print and buy official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk with your computer, your printer, no special ink. You'll get discounts you can't get at the post office. It is the ultimate for fulfillment. So if you sell online, if you know every once in a while we'll buy something at Etsy and I get this crazy package and somebody has licked and placed stamps on it. And it's just, I look at that and I go, why? Why aren't you using stamps.com? If you sell on Etsy, eBay, Amazon, it will take the information from the website. You don't have to fill out forms. It prints a beautiful looking label with exactly the right postage, by the way. I know when they put stamps on there that either it's going to be too few or too many. You never get it exactly right. Never again. Stamps.com will always print precisely the right postage. In fact, you get this great USB scale with your Stamps account that makes sure you do that. You can also print out certified mail, return receipt, international customs form filled out completely automatically by Stamps.com. And they'll send an email out if it's, you know, saying your package is on the way, if there's a tracking code. Here's the deal. Use our promo code TWIT, and you're going to get a special offer. Go to stamps.com, click the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, and TWIT. We've got a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and up to $55 in free postage that you can use over the first few months of your account. I just love this. Stamps.com. It's all we use. Can I even, you know, I'll come in and say, hey, print me up a page of stamps. It's awesome. Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click the microphone at the top of the page and type in the word TWIT. By the way, I'm just reading that the NHL, Jill, is going to be using MLB Advanced Media for their streaming.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Seems like they've figured it out. They've solved the streaming issue. So, Apple TV, maybe with new deals, maybe not. This certainly needs a new user interface. I'd love to see an iPad Pro, although Pachkowski calls that a wild card. New iPhones.
We won't see, I don't think, if Apple's true to form, new hardware, right? It'll be the same form factor, but they'll add Force Touch, maybe a better camera.
New hardware next year. But if the camera's a lot better, that would be something to get excited about.
Yeah, does it feel like Apple's falling behind? The camera still looks great, but it's only 8 megapixels. Is that an issue?
It's really good, although lately I've seen comparisons where people are...
I think my S6 is as good, if not better. I think the LG G4 is as good, if not better.
Yep.
So that's got to worry.
They have real competition in a way they did not a year ago.
Yeah. But that's what's going to happen. You know, people talk a lot about fragmentation. We've got a new fragmentation chart from OpenSignal. 24,093 different Android devices, distinct devices, more than doubled from 2013. And nobody's really got the lion's share. This is the biggest one is the Galaxy S3, then the S4 and the S5. And then there's lots of little doohickeys like the HTC Desire and the iMobile iStyle and the Alcatel OneTouch. But, you know, you can use the word fragmentation, which is kind of a pejorative. Or you can say this is a vibrant ecosystem. And it's hurtful to Apple because the iteration, the innovation happens so much faster when you're putting out a new phone every few months. And Apple's only doing it every year and only new hardware every 2 years.
Although, I mean, 23,999 or something of those phones, Apple is not paying attention to.
They don't care about the low end.
Yeah, they're just a handful that are serious competition and
right.
from companies that tend to put out one major new flagship phone per year.
Samsung, in fact, struggling a little bit, even though they dominate. They're 47.5% of the Android market share. I'm sorry. It was 47. It's now down to 37 in a couple of years. Still dominant. So that's the only one Apple has to think. And they don't even have to worry about the low-end Samsung. They have to only worry about the top of the line, right?
I think the Android ecosystem doesn't take into account all the fast-rising brands, you know, the Xiaomi... The yeah. OnePlus, the, you know, Micromax and, you know, all those kind of native brands from China and India. I think they are doing their own version of Android. They're doing their own version of phones. I think those guys are going to drive this market. I think Samsung is a little bit on the back foot there right now in because these smaller companies have, like, huge markets and... They're actually way more cooler than the Samsung. I think I was talking to somebody the other day who's was visiting India and came back, and he was telling me that Samsung has lost its cool in all these Asian markets. It's just not a cool brand anymore because it's like doing too many things and all over the map, and it doesn't really have a market positioning. However, I think when you think about Apple, you know, they put out technology way far ahead of everybody else, but the things they put out are actually usable, right? Like, nobody's talking about hacking their fingerprint scanner, or their camera doesn't have to have the most amount of megapixels, but yet pictures are still coming out better than any other camera, which is...
Yeah, well, I think you're half right. I think that Apple, in fact, isn't ahead of anybody else, but I think you're exactly right that when they do put out a feature, it works better than others. They did lead with fingerprints. But NFC, they finally got NFC. They finally got touch to pay.
But the NFC didn't really work, right? Like, for the longest time, it
right.
was like...
Till Apple did.
There.
Yeah.
No, it's like, I think a lot of the time, technology, you have to know when to market it to people, right? Coming out too soon is just a feature which nobody knows what to do with. I think camera-wise, I'll give you that Nokia phones had better cameras, but, you know, the iPhone takes really great pictures. They are making so much progress on the software inside their, you know, the visual computing part. They're doing really better than everybody else.
I feel like, though, we know that and we care about it. That's not really why people buy iPhones. That's a small slice. Most people buy iPhones because it's the default.
It's a good phone, and it takes great pictures. Like, literally, you cannot explain to people what is a great picture. It should take great pictures. And other people keep talking about megapixels. And, you know, You just, like, look at the phone. You take a
picture. Nobody
like,
cares about megapixels. I don't think people know that it's 8 megapixels or that Samsung is doing 13. I don't think they care. And I don't even know if they care about specs or anything. I think that they... I honestly feel people buy iPhones just because that's what everybody else buys. It's like buying Windows.
And one day, Android phone will work better than the iPhone, and that's the time Apple should be worried.
Think that time has come?
No, I think the phone still works better than most phones. Right? Like, it just is more intuitive than other phones. I don't want to be an apologist for Apple. I just feel that if you're an Android user, you get a lot more, you have to jump through more hoops than you do with the app.
All these years later, Apple still has the best app store. And there are still major apps that ship later for Android or don't ship at all for Android, or the updates come along later. I think if you want the single best selection of apps, not counting the things you can't do at all on an iPhone because Apple won't let you, Apple is still on top.
I think there's a lot of apps that Apple doesn't have or come to Apple after Android, and that number is flipping. It was Apple.
I'm always assuming it's going to, and I still haven't seen it happen.
I feel like it hasn't maybe completely, but I think it's on its way. I also think Apple suffers because they're gatekeeper on updates to apps, and I think that causes a problem. Apps do not get updated as rapidly on iOS. If you use an Android phone, you're getting app updates, 10 or 12 app updates every single day. I know that's a little annoying in some ways, but I think it makes me feel better that bugs are getting squashed faster because you don't have to get past the Apple gatekeepers to ship an update.
Why are the bugs there in the first place already?
Oh, right? Come on. You can't tell me that Android apps are more buggy than iPhone apps.
I think we just talked about the difference between Android and iPhone like a few minutes ago in the emergency contact information. And like apps which are there, but they're pretty mediocre. I think what I'm trying to say is that because there is an editorial process on the apps, maybe that pushes the quality or like a little bit higher, maybe forces companies to look at the bugs more closely before submitting to the app store.
Yeah, because
you're also talking about the very savvy consumer, right? Like the very savvy tech consumer knows about the differences between the app stores and maybe some of the different features of the camera. But at the most basic level, think about a person who's just buying their first smartphone. If they go with an iPhone, they have about three choices to make, right?
Like it's
the
really
three
simple.
Most recent models.
Yeah.
How much do I want to spend? Are these phones all going to work for 2 or 3 years? Great. If you look at Android, you don't even know where to start. Like, sure, if you went through all the work and read up on all the phones, you could probably find a phone that would make you very, very happy and have every feature you wanted. But the work of getting there is so exhaustive that it's easier to just say, here are my three options. They're going to work. They work with my carrier. Boom, let's do that.
Yeah, I think it's a no-brainer, very much like buying Windows in the 90s was a no-brainer. And I didn't think at the time Windows was better than Mac OS. I don't actually think iOS is better than Android now, but I can understand exactly, as you say, Jill, why normal people who don't really want to get involved in this warfare just say it's the default. It's easy. Nobody ever got fired for buying an iPhone.
Also, how much money you have in your pocket makes a huge difference, right?
Well, yeah.
If you got $50, you're not buying an iPhone.
Let's be fair. If you look at global sales, iPhone is dwarfed by Android. But because the low-end phones sell a lot more than the high-end phones.
And iPhone has retained its aspirational quality. I don't think Samsung is aspirational by any means. Like, I will not,
Someday, I will own an S5.
I don't need an S5 or an S6 or a Samsung.
No,
not because
right.
they're bad phones. They commoditize their own products. They just cut prices on their own products.
Isn't there an opportunity for somebody to make an Android phone that is the iPhone of Android phones?
I recently talked to the co-founder of OnePlus who said that's why they started the company. They figured there was no company in the Android ecosystems whose goal was to do the best possible design. And you can argue whether OnePlus has met their aspirations, but that was definitely what they set out to do. And they've sold 1.5 million phones despite not having been around very long.
Compared to Apple. In the same time frame, Apple sold 150 million
phones. But OnePlus is a really small company.
Right.
They've had trouble having units to sell at all. So I think they've had some success.
I'm ordering my OnePlus 2 on Tuesday.
Yeah, I fell in love with that phone. First Android phone I wanted to own.
Yeah. Yeah. Although no NFC on this one, no wireless charging, no fast charging. But the battery life was so good last year. I'm hoping it will be as good on this new one. Yeah, it's very interesting for me. You know, one of the roles I like, and I think you like this too, Om, is sitting a little bit back and watching, because I just find it fascinating to see the anthropology of all this is fascinating.
I love like how much this is the new sport, right? Like people talk about their devices and they get so angry and passionate about it. And it's like, you know, one of the great joys of like not being a professional writer anymore, not having to write these stories and have to deal with the comments after
that. The comments.
You know, buy whatever phone you feel like. I got nothing.
I got nothing to prove. Apple's Music, which has been out now for a month and a couple of weeks, according to Apple, has done all right. They say, and by the way, this is unprecedented. Apple very rarely releases this kind of information. They say, according to Eddie Q, 11 million trial members and 2 million of them paying for the family plan. They're actually paying $15 a month for the family plan. They say they're happy with that number. I have to say they must be. That's 10 times the number that was using the Beats music service when Apple bought it. It was 110,000. So that's good news. But there you go. That's another example of the tyranny of the default. It's an icon on your screen. Well, might as well try it. Do you think, given the issues some people have had with Apple Music, that Apple will keep those the lion's share of those 11 million people after that free 3 months runs out?
I think it has the potential to grow a lot, because right now it's kind of scary because there's been so much coverage of glitches and music disappearing and all kinds of problems. And Apple is likely to iron those out. And it might be a more appealing proposition 6 months from now.
So maybe in time. I talked to my son. I said, you want to do the family plan on Beats? I'm sorry, on Apple Music? And he said, why? I said, well, because it only cost me $15 and I can have all of you on it. He said, no, I like Spotify.
There you go.
There you go. That was literally the end of the conversation. It was like I couldn't persuade him. No, I like Spotify.
Okay. I have to say the Beats Radio is so good.
You listen to Beats One?
Oh, yeah. I love the radio.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It's just like I like the idea of, you know, somebody doing the curation of the music and
really
bringing it up. There's a little surprise element to it. It's like, oh yeah, I like this song. It's like, just, you know, just like it just is a nostalgic feeling, the idea of a radio station, which is actually, and I also like the idea of it being global, right? You know, the day it launched, I think I was in Paris that day, and I was listening to it on like a really hot Paris afternoon. And like I was listening to this music, which was essentially all late night tunes from LA, I guess, at that time. It was so much fun. It just felt like you're listening to.
Let's listen. You know, let's listen to a little. What's playing right now on Beats One? It's Lose It featuring Rick Ross and Lil Wayne.
What are you kids listening to? Turn that down!
Oh, you're very hip.
No.
Does that make you one of them? I try to listen. There's 12 hours of live stuff. There's L.A. with Zane Lowe, who's the BBC One guy that they stole, who I'm told is good. I never hear him. Then there's a New York DJ, I can't remember his name, and there's Julie Antonuga in London, right?
Oh, so good.
You like Julie?
Oh, she's
because if so good. You feel like you're in the club, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They do need to add a couple of DJs, somebody.
Yeah, it's only 12 hours of the 24.
Yeah, but there's still more 12 hours to go. Right?
Interesting thing. Apparently, they have licenses with the music industry to do more channels. It's not just one. They could do Beats 2. And I guess if you think about it, the name Beats 1 implies there would be a Beats 2, 3, or 4. Maybe something for us older folks.
Actually, Ohm, you like it.
I do love it.
So does it give you a little taste of home, Jill Duffy, there in beautiful India?
You know, I'm not so much into music, but I've been looking a lot lately at a different category of music streaming apps, which are ones for working out. So, you know, I read a lot about fitness tech.
I like what Spotify's doing.
So Spotify Running, this is a new feature in Spotify's mobile app. If you are a premium subscriber, when you run, it will match. It will find some music that matches your cadence, or I think it's just your running cadence right now is what they do.
So you start it, and then you start running, and then it gives you something that's appropriate?
And it finds out, what are your beats like for your steps, and find some music that matches that. So there are some other apps that do the same thing. One is called Spring Moves, and it does the same thing. So if you are running or wearing a heart rate monitor, I believe, it will match music to that beat. Then there's another one called Rock My Run, and I think it's this one, that when you wear a heart rate monitor, it actually has a song already, and it speeds up or slows down based on how fast or slow your heart rate is going. So that one, actually, I was really excited to try it out. But what happened was the music sounded just kind of weird and frenetic, even when it was like electronic music with no lyrics or anything. It just sounded off, right? Because it was changing based on how fast or slow I was going. Another one I've been using lately is called Fit Radio, F-I-T Radio. And I really like the yoga channels on there, which sounds a little new agey, but it's not. It's actually some really interesting DJ mixes of electronic music with a good beat for that pace of an activity. So if you do a lot of yoga or even like mild weightlifting, I feel like it's good music for that.
Really? You do a lot of mild weightlifting?
I do. I'm not a heavy, heavy weightlifter, but I don't know. How would you say that?
No, I like it. Mild weightlifting, I like it. No, it's good. I'm going to do more of that. I need to do more of that.
I'm just not like a power lifter.
Yeah. I could see you, though, with the chalk on your hands all taped up. Just really. All right. So Apple Music. Sounds like they've really, I mean, given that they started with something with 110,000 subscribers, I think 11 million, even if only 10% survive, is going to be a good number.
I do like Beats Radio, but I don't care much for everything else. I'm a huge fan of SoundCloud as well. I
think SoundCloud?
So much more fun, and SoundCloud. It's got so much more energy there because you find music, which is, it's more like emerging in many ways. You see a lot of remixes and there's a lot more creativity.
My younger son listens to SoundCloud all the time. It's interesting you should say that. You're very hip, Ohm.
Yeah, I'm the hip.
It's kind of more
man.
Like a YouTube model, right? Like SoundCloud is more the YouTube model if anybody can upload.
Yes.
So there's more stuff to explore. You get the high end, you get the low end, you get a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Yeah, and he likes the YouTube too, yeah.
Yeah, I think they won't surprise me to see them do like a Spotify style,
I think an interesting thing that, and I've mentioned this before, which is really that Spotify lives only at the, on the tolerance of the record labels, and at any moment the record labels could just pull the plug and say, this is not a good idea. Let's remove, let's yank it, and they can yank it from any of these. None of these guys have a viable model.
Nobody really has a business model.
There's no business. There's no real business model here.
Actually, that's not true. I think Spotify is owned, the record labels own enough of Spotify. They're not going to pull the rug on them. And I also, they need this badly. They need something. The record label are in the same place as television companies.
Yeah, we may agree on that, but I don't know if the labels know it.
Yeah, well, just because they're delusional doesn't mean it's the fact.
They're crazy.
I think the thing is, they're going to push people back into piracy if they start much.
Well, I think that's the only thing keeping them honest at this point. I guess they're doing better than the networks in the movie industry, but they haven't shown a lot of understanding of what their business is. And
they still seem amazingly backward, given that we're 15 years into this.
Do we even need a record industry? I mean, even that term seems anti-artistic, the record industry. It sounds like a factory cranking out hits. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, it is. And true artists, I think, no longer need the record industry. They can go direct to the listeners. It feels like the record industry is an anachronism.
I think
collapse.
You look at the streaming industry and the record industry, and you start to view the world of music in a certain way, and you, and then you look at it from an artist's perspective, oh my God, things are not very good for the artist.
No.
And the only way they can stay relevant is through live performances.
Yes.
And that's hard work. And I think this is...
artists are going to work for a living. I'm just...
You know, like if you have to tour 300 days out of 365, they can't
That's hard work.
So, and
I
it's
don't
not
think you
like
have to do that.
And not all of them are, like, famous, right? Like, not all of them make, like, you know, tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, but if you could make a living, a good living doing it, I think that would be a good thing. And I think that more more musicians have a better shot at making a good living, while fewer musicians have a shot at being platinum artists. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. I do feel that, again, here, too, someone or the other will come up with a new model of figuring out how to connect artists to their fans in a more effective way, which is, you know, like one of the companies our fund is involved in is called Bandcamp. And
that's huge.
And you know, I see that and I find so much amazing music there. So you start to think it's like there is something much bigger which will happen in the industry. It can't just be...
Well, I think Bandcamp's a great example, actually. That's an example of artists going directly to their audience, right?
Yeah. I think we just have had the old idea of creative industries, which is, again, I keep talking about the mass. Everything was, you know, built around the idea of mass market. I don't think that idea works anymore. I'm not going to go and say that, you know, long tail or anything. I just feel... The idea of mass audience, you know, mass media, that idea is off the past now.
That's the theme of this show.
Yeah.
Is the future is fragmented, and it's a good thing. Let a million blossom, a million flowers bloom. I remember talking to Paul Simon. Nice name drop, huh? At dinner. We were at dinner, Paul Simon and I. The Paul Simon of Simon and Garfunkel. That Paul Simon.
Not the senator.
Not the senator, Paul Simon. And we were talking about the music industry, and he said, yeah, but Leo, I worry, because his two kids, I guess, are musicians. I didn't know that. And I said, Paul, you made it. You don't have to worry about it. He says, yeah, but I worry for my kids, because they want to be musicians. They want to be working artists. And it's not clear what path they should follow. But what is clear is they can't follow their dad's path. That platinum artist, that's not going to happen. Paul Simon, you've heard of him? All right, I just thought I'd do a little name drop. Well, we take a break. Hey, you know, if you missed anything this week on Twit, fortunately, we've edited it all down into 60 seconds. You can watch right now.
Previously on Twit.
Are you ready to go surfing in your sofa?
Tech news today.
China's slide into a new totalitarianism when the Chinese government announced plans to station police officers inside major tech companies.
I kind of get the sense of desperation in China. They keep trying to lock down the internet more and more there.
Mac Break Weekly.
You need a Nico Girard Pinnacle watch, a high-end Swiss watch, and on the other end, the Apple Watch. There is a gold version, $112,000 in.
You got to hand it to them. They found a way to make the stainless steel watch even more expensive.
Tech news tonight.
Engadget reports that researchers in Japan recorded children in an Osaka shopping mall interacting with a robot. I mean, punching, kicking, hitting, shaking, and verbally abusing the robot. So the takeaway from the story is we do not have the robots to fear. It is the children that we should fear.
Twit, the happiest place on earth.
Coming up this week on Thursday, August 13th, Samsung will hold one of their big Unpacked events. We're expecting Samsung to introduce the Galaxy Note 5 and Galaxy S6 Edge Plus. And, of course, we'll be covering the event live at 8 a.m. Pacific, 1500 UTC at twit.tv/live. That's what's coming up this week. Back to you, Leo.
Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting and invoicing solution for you. If you're a small business owner, an entrepreneur, I know I loved FreshBooks. Man, that saved my life. The worst thing about being a freelancer was doing the invoices at the end of the month. You'd fire up Excel, you'd get all your expenses, your hours, then you'd fire up Word and that little template I made and stick the stuff in there, and then, oh, yeah, I'm invoicing in Canada. I got to convert it to Canadian dollars. Ay, ay, ay. FreshBooks solved all that for me. This is a while ago. Actually, I started using them in 2004. Super easy to use invoicing software that looks professional, makes billing painless, and you get paid faster. This actually is true, but they have research that says you get paid on average 5 days faster, and that's because your clients who actually want to pay you hate paying you, paying the bills as much as you hate sending the bills. But with an invoice that comes from FreshBooks, there's a button right on it that says pay. They can use all the online payment services out there, and it makes it easy for them, so they pay you. It's just everybody loves it. Everybody's happy. And if you ever have any questions, the FreshBooks support rock stars are famous for their knowledge, and they're right there in the FreshBooks offices ready to help you with any questions. FreshBooks, simple. There they are. Aren't they a cute, cute bunch? I love them. FreshBooks.com/twit. You can try it free for 30 days. Can I ask a little favor when they ask, how did you hear about us? Could you mention Twit? Because I think they forgot I exist. FreshBooks.com. Tell them Leo sent you. FreshBooks.com/twit. Put the word twit in the how did you hear about us section. You got 30 days free. Ba-bum. Did we all read Theft, Lies, and Facebook Video? The posting from Hank Green, YouTube star, VidCon creator. He says Facebook is lying when it says it's streaming more video than YouTube, partly because they miscount it. And then he also talks about something called freebooting, which is apparently, I didn't know this, widespread practice on Facebook. Big brands will steal, they'll download YouTube videos from, quality creators, and they'll put them on their page to get artificially get more likes and views. He says as a creator, Facebook is not a good platform for him compared to YouTube. And he thinks Facebook needs to do a better job. Anything to say about that? I have to say, if you're a brand, if you're a creator, I should say, if you're not putting native video on Facebook, you're kind of missing the boat, right? Do you do that?
We have our video all over, yeah.
Yeah, and you don't put a link to a YouTube video. You upload it to Facebook, right?
I mean, some of the stuff you said was pretty eye-opening in terms of if you link to a YouTube video, people will not see it in anywhere near the quantities they will if it's native.
Whether Facebook's doing that on purpose or not, you still have to kind of...
I mean, I do feel like in the long term, Facebook has to cater to people like Hank Green. And because of that, eventually in the long term, they will do things that will make him happier.
Right.
Because as he points out, they're not doing stuff right now to make him happy. And there are two superpowers of online video, YouTube and Facebook.
That happened fast. You wouldn't have said that a couple of years ago, would you? Facebook is one of the is like in the same breath as YouTube.
They're the closest thing.
Yeah.
A few years ago, there was one superpower.
Now there are two. But Facebook is superpower in every respect. Matt Russoff, writing in Business Insider, Facebook is the undisputed king of the tech industry. Any dispute? Anybody want to dispute that?
Yeah, he should have just said for now.
For now.
Right. Because I've read the same headlines about Microsoft,
yeah,
and Cisco and Netscape and Apple when I was very, very young. So everybody says that things are forever and they never are. That's the beauty of tech industry. You know, we used to say Google is the undisputed king of technology. And wait, really? Now you're going to put Facebook there? So I don't know. Like, I think people just forget that everything is like, has a time value attached to it.
He does make that point at the end of his...
Yeah, but there is a stickiness to Facebook because that's where all your friends and family are. What would it take to put Facebook on the back burner? I mean, it would have to be a cataclysmic shift. Like,
I'll tell you, I've had a pretty rough experience with Facebook lately. I think, you know, like you said, Leo, it's for friends and family. I do go there to keep up with people, to see what's going on. But I really dislike the feed that I get. And I know that feed is curated and ever-changing,
yeah,
based on my previous actions, my clicks, things I go shopping for online elsewhere.
If you hate your feed, it's your fault.
It is my fault. It's my fault for not spending 8 more hours on Facebook curating my feed, right?
Right.
Why on earth would I do that? I see so much stuff that I don't care about. I roll my eyes at. Yeah. I don't want to see. And I don't watch videos on Facebook for that reason primarily, as I know if it's there, it's probably not material that's of interest to me. So I go and I actually have a blocker on my browser that limits my Facebook usage to 10 minutes a day. And I use Stay Focused.
But see, wait a minute. Isn't that telling? You feel like you need something to keep you from using more Facebook?
Well, so I set that up a long time ago, and I do pop in, right? Like, and I check out some stuff. I see what's going on, but I don't want to spend a lot of time there because I find I'll start scrolling, looking to see if there's anything of interest.
So if you didn't have this blocker, would you spend more time there?
I would probably leave it open more than I should.
Yeah.
So that's another thing. I like to log out of Facebook. I don't use the Facebook app on my phone. I don't use any geolocation tracking when I'm using Facebook in a mobile browser. Like I'm kind of sensitive to that. I don't want to be logged into Facebook all the time, letting it see everything else that I'm doing.
If you need to use Antabuse, not to use Facebook, then you probably really like Facebook.
Yeah, it's a mixed message, isn't it?
Yeah. but no, I feel the same way. Often when I use Facebook, I feel bad. I want to take a shower afterwards. But I do notice that changes sometimes. Like, of late, it's been better. And I don't know if it's fully my fault. They're clearly tweaking it all the time, right? Constantly. But again, if Facebook isn't, like, for now and forever king, what kind of thing will happen to dethrone them? Is there a MySpace going to come along and unthrone Facebook home, or is it something? What's going to happen?
So don't you remember where we started? We started talking about messaging. Messaging as an interface for communications and, you know, staying in touch with each other. We don't know, but you're already beginning to see that it was a big enough threat for Facebook to buy WhatsApp for $20 billion.
Yeah.
It was a big enough threat for them to launch Facebook Messenger. So clearly, something like that will come out of nowhere and will be a threat to Facebook.
And come to think of it, it's not. Maybe we're looking in the wrong place if we're looking for another technology. What it really is behavioral changes, so that Google became less dominant, not because somebody beat them in search, but because search became less important.
I mean, like AOL was not replaced by something similar to AOL.
Yeah.
You're never replaced by something similar. Microsoft is not in trouble because there's a new operating system.
Yeah. And even because the cloud meant operating systems irrelevant.
And even Microsoft Office is still doing fine. It hasn't been beat by other Office suites. So it's never something similar.
That's a good
It's
point.
Always something different.
All right. So we don't know what it'll be because it's not going to be a Facebook-like thing. It's going to be something else.
And that's what makes tech so much more fun and interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all paradigm shift all the way down.
I do think they bought WhatsApp partially because WhatsApp was one of the more plausible, scary competitors just because of the enormous growth.
Was it defensive only?
Not entirely, no. I mean, but I think that was probably part of it. If you were going to make a list before they bought it of things that might compete with Facebook, they would have been high up on the list.
Look at Twitter. Twitter struggling all of a sudden. I don't know if you'd ever would have said Twitter was on top of the world, but it certainly looked like it had an unassailable position as the internet's dial tone. Now we're hearing that Dick Costolo says he's going to leave as soon as they find a new CEO. We don't know who that CEO is. Twitter's stock down so much, people are saying there might even be, Google might even just do a hostile takeover. Is Twitter coming back, or is it all over for Twitter? I mean, how could it even be all over?
It's not all over.
Can't be all over. I wouldn't mind, but I'm just saying. It's all over for Google Plus, right? Not that it ever was like all that.
You were a big user of Google Plus.
I liked Google Plus. But see, what I'm looking for isn't necessarily the biggest, most successful platform. Because I'm in some ways that's what I don't want, because I don't want everybody to be using it. I want something exclusive. I want a private club just for me and my close personal friends.
That's kind of where they're going. They say Google Plus is going to be about special interests.
Yeah.
Rather than the masses.
Communities. Yeah.
Which kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
I was a big fan. So.
You never liked it?
Nah.
Nah. You know better.
No, I just didn't care much for yet another social network from a company which is not very social.
Are social networks over?
No. I mean, human beings are social. So to say that social networks are over, you say human beings are over. I just think Google as a company was all about using engineering and logic and algorithms to make, search web faster and show ads against it. That's it. You know, anything beyond that is just like them trying to convince themselves that they're better than that. I think they don't love what they do, which is sell ads. That's pretty much Google's big issue is.
They're good at that.
They're very good at that. Yeah. They're probably the best at that.
Yeah.
But it seems like, Facebook is getting really, really good at that too.
Well, and there's this problem because I think advertisers are starting to realize if Google admitted 56% of all the ads they sell are never seen. That's not a good number.
You know, the guy we don't talk about enough is Jeff Bezos. And I don't know, that's a long time ago I talked to him. And he often talked about, like, why does advertising exist? And he pointed out the core reason advertising exists is to sell people things, whether it was physical things or digital things, or in terms of, like, content, it's selling content. But it was all about getting people to buy something else. And he says, what if you remove that need to buy something else, like remove the middleman, the advertising, and made it easier for people to go from let's say, what you and I are talking, straight to a purchase, buy something from that. Like, you and I talk about a device, we like it, other people believe what we're saying, and they go buy it.
There's oh, that's always better than advertising, isn't it?
Right. I think the internet enables that behavior much more effectively.
Yes. In fact, the reviews on Amazon, for me anyway, are a must stop before I buy anything. I read the reviews.
If you look at Wirecutter, is another good example of a company which is succeeding by just being saying, this is what we really feel about this device. And if people want to buy it, they just click on a link. Or they don't have to click on their link. Like, that's the even... So I think the need for advertising is going to start to go away.
Does Wirecutter not have any ads?
Nope.
So the revenue they make, and it's, I'm sure, significant at this point, comes from the affiliate codes on the links.
Yeah.
That Brian Lamb's no dummy.
No, because he's catering to just one audience, which is his reader.
Yeah.
I think that's the number one thing which works for that site is that, they take everything they write very seriously. If you don't, if I can't trust what they have written, I'll probably not shop or never click there. So I think that's the key thing.
They are moving away from their original premise, which was the one. They have a broader range of product recommendations now.
Yeah.
Maybe that's telling. It used to be the what's the best TV now? It's what's the best $500 TV? What's the best small TV?
Again, like I said, we are all different snowflakes, so everybody has a different need. Yeah. You remember Consumer Reports? They used to have all these variations on technologies and so. Oh, sorry, on reviews. What reviews?
Right.
What kind of
no ads? No ads.
No ads.
No ads.
And that's what really it is. I think.
But advertisers hate it because they can't buy the review.
Well, you have to make a product which people want to buy.
Oh, come on. That's too hard.
Yeah, I know.
Interesting. I think Bezos is smart.
Yeah. I think we should watch him, what he does, rest of the industry does 5 years later.
Well, he had a loss with the Fire Phone, which is basically a total write-off. But I have to say, Echo is pretty amazing.
Echo is fun.
And and people have a much, even though I don't know if Echo's really better than Siri or Google now, people like it better, which is interesting.
Cool. I mean, as a service, it has a lot of work left.
So right.
Siri, I kind of wish they would enable it to work either as an interface for Google Now or Siri. But the hardware idea is great.
Speaking of end of the line, Nokia has sold off the Maps division. I don't know how much. I don't know what's. I don't know what Nokia has left now. Here Maps, which were in play, I would imagine that there are a number of companies would have liked this. Uber was rumored to be one of the companies on the market because Maps are very important to them. It ended up being sold to a consortium of BMW, Audi, and Daimler, but not for a lot of money, only 2.8 billion euros, which is, I would have thought it'd be worth more, but I think we were talking about this on Windows Weekly. The problem is it's one thing to buy it, but now you've got to spend millions every year to maintain it and update it and make it better. So it's an expensive product to own. Maybe that's
They have to own it, right? Without that, they don't have any mapping data. They have to own and maintain it so that they can get proprietary data around traffic conditions, maps, stuff like that, so that whenever they introduce, you know, self-driving cars or automatic cars, they need this data. Like, it's without that, they can't compete with Google.
You just put it all together for me. Autonomous vehicles.
Yeah. And or even, you know, semi-autonomous.
Yeah. Well, if you're just making a car with a GPS in it, you could rent it from other companies. But if you're building an autonomous vehicle, your whole business is relying on the maps. You better own them. Very interesting. Which is, by the way, why Uber wanted it, because its business is relying on the maps as well. I think we should wrap it up here. We've gone on long enough. The sun is finally up in Chennai. Birds are singing.
It's coming up, yeah.
It's coming up. Hey, Jill, thank you so much. I had no idea it was so early in the morning. I'm not sure we would have called you, but if you don't mind doing it again, we'll have you back.
Yeah, no, this is my crazy lifestyle now, so I'm all in.
All right. We love having you on. For PC Magazine, look for her article on those ICE programs tomorrow at PCMag.com. You can follow her on the Twitter, Jill E. Duffy.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. Thanks to O'Malik as well. Always great to see you now that you're back. You're out of mourning. You stopped wearing black. You've taken the crepe off the mirrors in your house. You're ready to venture out into the world.
Yes.
Yeah. Which was worse, the heart attack or the closure of GigaOm?
I think it's part of the journey, my friend. Yeah. I can't say one was worse than the other.
You're my guru.
Both taught me very valuable lessons.
I'm learning from you. You're the valuable lesson, Om. It's great to have you. Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. Om.co. He is the man with the only two-letter Twitter handle, @OM. Rock it. Thanks, Om.
Thank you.
You can go out clubbing now.
Mm-hmm.
Julie Antonuga's waiting for you.
Yes.
Harry McCracken, always great to see you. You went up through the traffic and the fog and the smog. We're glad you made the trip up with Marie. It's good to see you too, Marie. Great pictures from the audience. I've been liking them on Facebook. What else do you want to talk about? Fastcompany.com, what you're working on?
Fastcompany.com. I have a bunch of cool secret projects I'm working on. I have a good story going up this coming Friday. But it's super secret right now. But come back on Friday.
Follow them on Instagram, too.
The better
too.
A story is, the less likely it is you can talk about it ahead of time.
Yeah, right. So. That means it's a good one. Yeah. Did you... you were at Time for a while, right?
I was at Time for a little while.
Did you see the very funny article on what's wrong? Why does Time magazine hate geeks? The cover of, I guess, this week's Time is of Palmer of Oculus Rift looking like a complete and utter nerd. Would you be, if you were Palmer Lucky, if you would you feel bad with that picture on the front cover? Let's see if I can find it.
He actually took it really well. He's a good sport. And if you look at his Facebook page, he has been sharing that cover and the variants on that cover that people have been putting together.
That's pretty funny.
Do people read Time Magazine?
He's really, is that the cover? That's just a video. Let me see if I can find the...
That's the image from the cover. Yeah.
And then,
There we go. You got it.
Oh, actually, somebody put a dinosaur under him. I don't know if that's... That's the meme. That's the left is the actual cover, and the right is even better. Apparently, there's an internet meme of Palmer Luckey images.
If you write for magazines, you have to really quickly get emotional separation between you and the covers, given that not only do you not do the covers, but they don't really check in with you about how you feel about the covers.
I'm sorry. This is for the video extras on the show today. Lucky Apostyle. Where is he in this one? I don't see him. Oh, that's him.
That's him. Looking very
just sitting there. Not dancing on the beach or nothing. Oh, King of the World. Oh, my. With Vladimir Putin on horseback, flying through space in virtual reality with, I don't know, some wrestler on the moon. You could be anywhere in Oculus Rift. Thanks for joining us. We do This Week in Tech every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC, or 3:30 in the morning Madras time. If you'd like to join us, we'd love it if you would. But if you can't be here live, and by the way, there is room in studio for you because everybody left. You can email tickets at twit.tv for your own very own seat. If you can't watch live on-demand audio and video of all of our shows on the website, twit.tv, on YouTube, and wherever you subscribe to podcasts, please do so because we would love to see you back here next week. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. Another twit this is in the can. Amazing. Bye-bye. You're the twit.